From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a look at the future with a man who's already been there, Ray Bradbury. His novels, The Martian Chronicles and Fahrenheit 451, are science fiction classics. While Ray Bradbury deals with the future, audio engineer Jack Towers deals with the past. Towers is an expert at restoring vintage jazz recordings. His latest project, removing the pops, hisses, and clicks from some legendary recordings by Charlie Parker. Today, Jack Towers tells us how he does it. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of pianist George Bolette performing music by Chopin. And as the Republican convention continues, language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg examines the history of political oratory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Ray Bradbury started thinking about space when he was 8, started writing about it when he was 12. When he was 51, the Apollo 15 crew landed on the moon and named a crater after one of his books. Ray Bradbury is one of America's premier science fiction writers. His books include Fahrenheit 451, Something Wicked This Way Comes, Dandelion Wine, The Martian Chronicles, and The Illustrated Man. He's imagined the future in some of his fiction. He's also attempted to conceptualize the future in three-dimensional form. He was idea consultant to the U.S. Pavilion in the 1964 World's Fair, and he worked on the design of Spaceship Earth for the Epcot Center at Disney World. About his writing, Bradbury has said he likes to deal with human problems, like what it would be like to be an average woman on the night before she goes off to Mars to join her husband. His new book is a collection of short stories titled The Toynbee Convector. The first story uses one of the oldest ideas in science fiction, the time machine, but gives it a new twist. Bradbury explains what the story is really about.
The problem of the world is doomsayers. We're surrounded by negative people. I can't stand them. I found out about them when I was 9 years old. Everyone made fun of me in the fourth or fifth grade because I collected the Buck Rogers comic strips. That was 1929. The future was never going to arrive. And I've been surrounded by people who never believed in the future. And it was true then. It's true today. So I, in that particular year, I tore up my comic strips, and a month later, I burst into tears and said to myself, why am I weeping? Who died? And the answer was me. I had allowed these fools to kill me and to kill the future. So from that time on, I decided I'd never listen to another damn fool again in my life. And I went back and collected the Buck Rogers comic strips and insured my future and began to write about it, became a writer. So I've learned that by doing things, things get done. I'm not an optimist. I'm an optimal behaviorist. So that particular story in my new book, The Toynbee Convector, is based on my conviction that we insure the future by doing it.
You might hate me for giving this away, but in your story, The Toynbee Convector, about someone who's traveled back in a time machine, we really find out that he never really did travel in a time machine, but what he did was build little miniatures of civilizations and imagine a future. And
that's correct.
And he brought back the architecture that he had imagined from the future.
Yep.
And it was an optimistic vision, which made everybody much more comfortable about the present that they were living in. And reading that, I thought to myself, well, that's in a lot of ways what you've been doing, both as a writer and a designer, is thinking about the future and giving that to us. Some of your visions have been optimistic. Some of them have been pessimistic.
Well, they're all optimistic. Now, if I do a pessimistic story, then I offer the solution. I hate people who criticize our society or any society and don't offer solutions. So I feel it's beholden upon the critic to immediately, in the moment of criticism, to offer the solution. So I never am negative about the future without saying, why don't we do this? I'd like to go down and redesign Cape Canaveral. It's not working as a theater right now. It should be used as a theater to promulgate the future, and we're not using it. So I have solutions for these things.
One of the visions of the future that you had to conceptualize was for the United States Pavilion of the Future for the 1964 World's Fair. Would you think back for us about what you designed for that, what you imagined the future to be back then?
Well, the people who were in charge of the United States Pavilion back in 63, 64, 65 came to me and said, can you write a a 400-year history of the United States in 17 minutes flat with a full symphony orchestra. I said, yes, I can do that. And so I wrote a prose poem with an orchestra and had it spoken by John McIntyre. And I put in our whole root system of our fabulous past, which indeed is fabulous, and then at the very end told us where we could go with this root system. In other words, it's no use having roots for a tree if you don't grow the tree itself and have it produce things. And at the end of my show, I predicted the ultimate victory of a Apollo spacecraft going into space and landing on the moon. And by gosh, a few years later, they did that.
Well, it's funny, when they did, I think it's when they landed on the moon that one of the craters was named after you.
Well, it was named after one of my books.
I'm sorry, after Dandelion Wine. It's called the Dandelion Crater.
Yeah, I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, you must be. So now you're still imagining the future. You still you designed one of the Epcot pavilions, I believe, and
The main building, Spaceship Earth, the interior of the building.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working right now. I'm working with the Euro Disney people to build the Disney Disneyland outside of Paris. I'm working for various museums on concepts to go into museums. And I've just created a traveling exhibit of animation for the Disney people, a whole history of animation over a period of 80 years, which will travel to Denver, Seattle, the Museum of Modern Art, and finally wind up at a museum down in Florida.
Do you ever get a little frustrated designing plans for the future that don't necessarily come true?
Well, they've all come true so far. And the thing is, we tell fabulous lies. All of our lives are fabulous lies. And then we run to put structures under the lie and make them true. I had to lie to myself when I was 15 that someday I would become a writer. Well, my work was just dreadful. All through high school and my 2 or 3 years out of high school, my stories were terrible. But I had to lie to myself that someday I would become excellent. And by gosh, by writing every day for 20 years, I became excellent. But we all have to do that. We have to kid ourselves late at night in the midst of our mediocrity that someday we'll be better.
Ray Bradbury is my guest, and his latest book is a collection of short stories titled The Toynbee Convector. One of your best-known books is Fahrenheit 451, mm-hmm. which is about to premiere this fall as an opera. You wrote the libretto. It's set in 2052 A.D., in which the firemen set fires, and they set fires to books. They're book burners. Mm-hmm. It strikes me as a subject that's unfortunately still very current.
In most countries of the world, not here, thank goodness. I get letters occasionally from librarians and city councilmen where a few books have been taken off shelves of libraries, and they want me to show up and lecture, and I say, no. You will make those teeny little tadpoles into big frogs and small puddles. I refuse to dignify stupid people like that. Just wait long enough, keep putting the books back on the shelf, and it will blow away. We have never had anything here like they had in China 20 years ago when they burned the books and the teachers and the librarians with them by the millions.
In the end of Fahrenheit 451, there's a colony of people who have preserved books by memorizing them. I'm sure you've thought about what book you would have memorized.
Yes, I have. Yeah, people ask me. Uh-huh. I think I would love to be the prefaces to the plays of George Bernard Shaw. Now, that's a huge thing to memorize because it's 2,000 pages of essays about all of his fabulous ideas. He was certainly, to me, the greatest writer of the 20th century. And because he was a pomegranate, just full of exploding seeds on any subject you want to talk about, religion, women's rights, femininity, war, space travel. He did it all.
I want to ask you about another short story in your new collection, The Toynbee Convector. The story is called The Thing at the Top of the Stairs, mm-hmm. and it's about an adult who's very afraid of the dark, as he was as a child, and he's afraid of walking up a staircase, an unlit staircase. There's a bulb that he has to turn on at the top of the staircase, mm-hmm. and he's afraid that waiting at the top of the staircase is a monstrous thing. Were you afraid of the dark when you were young?
Yeah, that's a true story. When I was 4, 5, 6 years old, we had the bathroom upstairs. And in the middle of the night when I had to go up there, I had to run halfway up the stairs, turn on the light before I could go the rest of the way. Well, when I was doing this, I'd always say to myself, now don't look at the top of the stairs because it will be waiting for you. And I never learned not to look because as soon as I looked up, there it was. And it was horrible. And I would scream and fall back down the stairs, and my mother or father would get up and sigh and say, oh, my God, here we go again. And they'd turn the light on for me and let me go upstairs. And so this is a vivid memory in my mind, and I write it so that other people, I suppose, reading it, will remember their own thing at the top of the stairs.
What shape did that it have in your mind?
That's a very hard thing to describe. I suppose it had a different shape every single night, maybe as the result of my seeing certain horror films that I dearly loved. You know, we all love horror films. And I saw The Hunchback of Notre Dame when I was 3, The Phantom of the Opera when I was 6. I think The Phantom stayed with me the longest. And it was probably The Phantom up there, with the moment when Patsy Ruth Miller tears off the mask of Lon Chaney and his face is revealed in all its gruesome detail.
I'm glad you mentioned The Hunchback of Notre Dame, too, because it's a movie I used to watch over and over and over again when I was growing up. The first time I saw it, it just terrified me. But I had to keep watching it again and again. I loved it so much. Did that movie scare you?
I don't know if it scared me. It touched me. Even when you're 3 years old,
yeah.
The Lon Chaney version was very sympathetic and sad and very moving. And then the Charles Laughton version was the same way. I think all of us, no matter how we look, born into this world, feel something like the hunchback.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter if you have a beautiful face or not. I've talked to a lot of beautiful people in later years and found out that they went through the same thing in high school that I did. I went around with my face down most of the time because I was suffering from the usual outbreaks on the face that most kids of that age have. But then in later years, I met some beautiful women and beautiful men, and they all confessed to the same feeling, regardless of how they looked. I think the Quasimodo appeals to all of us.
It was the Charles Laughton version that I've seen the most times. Now, I know you worked with Charles Laughton,
yep.
including working with him on an unproduced version of Fahrenheit 451. Did you ever talk with him about how potent The Hunchback of Notre Dame was for you?
Yes, I did. And we had a wonderful friendship. For a whole year there, about 30 years ago, I worked on a science fiction operetta for Charles and Elsa Lanchester, his wife. So that meant I was over at the house at least one day a week for almost a year. And he put on performances of the various Shakespearean plays for me, or scenes from the plays, scenes from Othello or Hamlet, or he did Lear at in England 1 year, and I was privy to his ideas on how to do Lear, or when he directed Major Barbara or The Apple Cart by Shaw. And the one thing that Charles Laughton gave to me that I've kept as a gift for all the years and has changed my life is him saying to me, use language for God's sake, because there's no language in the American theater anymore. We have no playwrights who use language, who care about saying something so beautiful and so correct. It has to be correct, it has to be true, but it can be beautiful, that it moves the heart and changes the lives of the people who see it. So when I went into full-time theater work, where I actually started when I was 12, but came back into it when I was 30, I dared to write language plays, and I'm still writing them. You can listen to what I have to say, and it sounds good as well as being true.
I want to get back to the fear that you felt when you were in the dark climbing up the stairs as a mm-hmm. child. Is that kind of terror a good experience for us, for a writer, especially someone who spends part of their time writing science fiction?
Or fantasy or any other thing.
Mm-hmm.
Any experience that touches you in any particular way is good. It can be a horrible experience. I saw a car crash when I was 15 here in Los Angeles, and 5 people died as a result of it. I arrived at the scene of the accident within 20 seconds of hearing the collision. It was the worst mistake I ever made in my life. I didn't know what I was running into. People had been horribly mangled and decapitated. So for months after, I was shaken by him. It's probably the reason I never learned to drive. I was terrified at automobiles for a long time after that. But I turned it into a short story called The Crowd 6 or 7 years later, and that was part of my Ray Bradbury Television Theater 2 years ago. It was one of the things we produced. So out of this horror, this really terrible event, you take something that has taught you a certain kind of fear, I suppose, and you pass it on to others and say, this is what the car can do. This is an example of what the car can do.
You know, some writers have made a lot out of the fact that you don't drive. You know, the irony, one of America's premier science fiction writers, envisioners of the future, mm-hmm. doesn't drive a car. Has that ever seemed ironic to you, or do you just accept that there's reasons you don't want to drive?
No, it's no different than love poetry, is it? We don't write love poetry in the middle of an affair, do we? We write love poetry when we're away from our loved one, or we anticipate a loved one. It's lack that gives us inspiration. Huh? It's not fullness. Occasionally fullness can do that. But not ever having driven, I can write better about automobiles than the people who drive them. I have a distance here. Perhaps I have a secret yearning to own a Maserati someday and go to hell. I don't know. But space travel is another good example. I'm never going to go to Mars. But I've helped inspire, thank goodness, those people who have built the rockets and sent our photographic equipment off to Mars. So it's always a lack, though, that causes you to write that kind of story.
Have you had any direct correspondence with astronauts who've traveled through space?
Well, I've met most of them, thank goodness. Life magazine sent me down to Houston back in early 1967, and I met 60 of them. This the Apollo missions were just beginning. So I got to meet almost everyone who finally wound up on the moon, and I bump into them on occasion over the years. It's a wonderful part of my life. I feel very fortunate that I not only started out with Buck Rogers in 1929, but wound up down at Houston, Cape Canaveral, in my own lifetime. I thought I would be a very old man by the time we landed on the moon. Well, I was only 49, and I feel privileged to be part of this greatest age in the history of the world.
Has the reality of space travel made speculation about space more or less interesting?
More interesting, because it involves our philosophy, it involves our sense of theology, it involves our sense of the miraculous. I mean, after all, we've been trying to figure out for tens of centuries, haven't we, what our place in the universe is, why we were created to be on the world, why we were given this opportunity to live. And I have my own answers. I have a religious relationship with the universe, and all the word religion means is to bind yourself to relate to gather all the sticks, all the facts, and look at them and try to figure out what it's all about. We're faced with two strange things, aren't we? The gift of life and the gift of death, and we haven't figured out either one. So space travel only intensifies our sense of obligation to the gift of life, to promulgate it, to go to the moon, to go to Mars, to go on beyond our solar system, and to take our civilization with it on the journey to Alpha Centauri. With all our stupidities, with all our inanities, with all our destruction, with all the things that we hate, but along with all the things that we love, and all the things that are brilliant, and all the things that are creative. So we have this darkness within us, and we have this bright light within us, and we're going to take both of them, and I accept that.
I want to talk with you more about your ideas, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Ray Bradbury, whose latest collection of short stories is titled The Toynbee Convector. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ray Bradbury is my guest. His many books include The Martian Chronicles, The Illustrated Man, Fahrenheit 451, and his newest, The Toynbee Convector. He's also written many plays and has served as a design consultant for several exhibits on the future. Let's talk about some of your movies. Now, Fahrenheit 451 was made into a movie directed by Louis Malle. Your story.
François Truffaut.
I didn't mean that.
It's okay.
The Illustrated Man was made into a movie. Now, you actually wrote the screenplay for a book that had nothing to do with your books, Moby Dick.
That's right.
And you really, I have to say, seemed like a very unlikely choice to adapt Moby Dick for the screen. And I was wondering how you got to write the screenplay.
Well, by staying true to my own sense of the poetic. Again, here's where the influence of Shakespeare on my life, the influence of the Bible, which I was raised on. And by staying true to my love of poetry and my love of metaphor, which you learn from the Old Testament, the New Testament, and you learn it from Shakespeare, to speak in tongues that are so vivid that people remember the metaphor. And also by staying in love with dinosaurs. I fell in love with dinosaurs when I was 5. And I was walking along the shore with my wife one night down Venice, California, this 1949, and we found the ruins of the old Venice Pier, all the bones and the skeleton, the tracks and the ties of the roller coaster lying there in the sea. And I turned to my wife and I said, I wonder what that dinosaur is doing lying here on the shore. She was very careful not to answer, and 3 nights later, and I heard something in the middle of the night. I sat up in bed, looked at all the fog out beyond the window, and way out in the Santa Monica Bay, I heard the braying, the calling, the oconing of the foghorn over and over and over again. And I said, yes, that's it. The dinosaur heard the foghorn blowing, thought it was another dinosaur calling from a billion years of slumber, and swam for an encounter, discovered it was only a damned lighthouse and a damned foghorn, tore the whole thing down, and died of a broken heart on the beach. So next day I got out of bed and wrote The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, sent it to the Saturday Evening Post. It was published. John Huston read that one story, And that changed my life forever, because he thought he smelled the ghost of Melville in that story. What he smelled in it was the ghost of Shakespeare and the ghost of the Bible, And so he called me on the phone and offered me the job. And a year later, when I was working on the screenplay one night, I said, John, how did I get this job? You know, everyone thought you were crazy. He said, well, I read that story about the dinosaur. And I said, well, I was very honest with you. I told you when I met you I'd never read Melville. But once I got into Melville, I discovered he had been inspired by the same people who inspired me. So we were twins. He had been called upon by Shakespeare to cough up the white whale. So Shakespeare came into his life very late. He had never read Shakespeare until he was 30 years old. And then Melville went off to Boston, found an edition of Shakespeare with large type. He had very weak eyes. That's the reason he'd never read him. Went home and fell madly in love with Shakespeare, threw all the whaling equipment out the door, and Shakespeare came under his window one night and called up to him and said, oh, Herman Melville, truly come you forth, but come you forth dressed as whale. And he breached the damned whale from out of the brow of Melville. And that's how Moby Dick got born.
Okay. Well, must have been pretty daunting to write the screenplay, rewriting Melville and then working with one of the great American directors, John Huston.
And that'll teach you to ask a small question.
Yeah, that's right.
Show me
a thing or two, yeah. I'm thinking of you writing in movies and working in movies and trying to reconcile that with something you once said. You once said, every time I get in a huge crowd of so-called creative people, I am not happy. Why not?
I wonder why I said that. Where did you see that?
Hey, don't ask me. I don't know. I forgot to write down where you'd said that.
It was. No, I'm not. I don't think that's true. I must have said something unlike that, because I am very happy around creative people. I've been working with the Disney people on and off for 18 years, and I'm as happy with them as someone playing basketball or football. I have yet to meet anyone in the Disney organization especially among the Imagineering people who built Disneyland, Disney World, and Epcot, that I didn't like, because we're all children and we play together and we have fun. And I go home every night happy, and I say to my wife, my gosh, I've been playing all day and they pay me for this. And you almost hate to take the money.
You started writing for science fiction. You started writing short stories. I forget whether it was for Weird Tales or Amazing Stories.
Super Science.
Okay. Now, the science fiction genre has changed a lot over the years since you've been writing.
Right.
And I wonder if the broadening of science fiction has affected your writing personally.
I don't pay attention to these things. When an idea hits me, I do it. Doesn't matter what field it's in. If it happens to be science fiction, swell. If it's fantasy, which is totally different, swell. If it's a murder mystery, good, I'll do that. Or I want to do a play, or I want to write a poem. Instantly, I just go do it. If we could only train our children to do things, huh? Don't think about them, don't talk about them, go do it. And when it's done, then you can talk about it, then you can show it to people. So I never think about, I'm just busy doing all my things and trying to figure out new ways that, on occasion of saying old things, saying the obvious, but saying it in a new way.
Do you read science?
Oh, yes, of course. But I'm not a scientist. I'm not a technician. I can't tell you how to build a rocket or a nuclear plant. I'm a moralizer on occasion. If I don't like the way things are going, then I write about that. But I try to keep up with especially magazines like the Smithsonian. A Scientific American is too scientific for me. I don't understand it. I wish I did. But I have the same problem with the Wall Street Week every Friday night. And I watch that and I turn to my wife and say, did you understand that? She said, no. I said, thank God, because I didn't either.
You've spent a lot of time imagining what the future might be like.
Mm-hmm.
What would you most like to be around to see about the future?
I'd like to come back every 50 years and see how we can use certain technological advances to our advantage, say, in education. I think we're doing a dreadful job of educating now. We're spending $200 billion a year, $300 billion, whatever the figure is, a heck of a lot of money, and we're getting very small results because we're neglecting the first grade and the second grade. That's where the whole thing lies. And we have to revamp all of our ideas about the first and second grade, which means intensifying...
Wait a minute. You don't want to come back and find out if we've landed on Mars or not, and if there's life on Mars. You want to come back and see how the grade schools are doing.
It's not going to do any good to land on Mars if we're stupid.
Uh-huh.
And I want to save the future generation. I want to teach them to read when they're 5 and 6 and 7 years old. If we don't do that, we lose them forever. It's no use having remedial reading, which takes years of time, when you can do the whole thing in the first grade. We have to intensify our objectives there. It won't cost any money. It doesn't cost a darn thing. First grade is very cheap. It's the later grades where you got to spend money if you don't do it right.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
My guest has been Ray Bradbury. His new book is titled The Toynbee Convector. It's published by Knopf. An opera version of his Fahrenheit 451 is scheduled to premiere this fall. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer James Conaway. His book, Kingdom in the Country, tells about the changing American West. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner, designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Fresh Air receives additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When a series of long-lost, legendary recordings by the late Charlie Parker came to light, Jack Towers got the call. Towers is considered one of the world's foremost experts at restoring vintage jazz recordings, bringing the performances of Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Lester Young back to life. Coming up, Jack Towers tells us how he'll go about restoring Parker's music. Cuban-born pianist George Bolet is best known for his interpretations of Franz Liszt. But in a new recording, Bolet performs works by Chopin. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg pounds the pulpit about the decline of political oratory. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Pakistanis are observing 10 days of mourning following the death today of their president, Zia-ul-Haq. As George Arney reports, the president and two Americans died when their plane exploded.
According to an official announcement, General Zia was killed when his C-130 aircraft exploded just after taking off from Babulpur. Reliable sources say that he'd gone there to witness the testing of a new American battle tank. The U.S. ambassador to Pakistan, Mr. Arnold Raipel, and an American brigadier general were traveling on the same plane. There's no information about whether the crash was caused by sabotage or whether it was an accident. Pakistanis are stunned by the news. General Zia has been in charge of the country's affairs for the past 11 years. The civilian chairman of the Senate, Mr. Ghulam Ishaq Khan, has taken over as acting president and is now chairing an emergency cabinet meeting, which is also being attended by military service chiefs. General Zia's arch-political rival, Benazir Bhutto, has welcomed it as a positive sign that constitutional paths are being followed.
George Arney reporting. U.S. officials were shocked by the death of President Zia, and they're studying the implications, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
President Zia was a key supporter of the Afghan rebels in their war against Soviet occupation forces. He allowed Pakistan to be used as a conduit for U.S. weapons on their way to the rebels. U.S. officials expect that policy to continue even with President Zia gone, because the policy had fairly broad support among the Pakistani people. The overriding concern in the Reagan administration right now is that political stability be maintained in Pakistan. The country has serious ethnic problems as well as strong political rivalries. Pakistan's reaction in the next few days and weeks depends largely on the cause of the crash that killed President Zia and his party. The cause has not yet been pinpointed, but one well-placed U.S. official, speaking on background, said this afternoon, "Everything I've heard suggests it wasn't an accident." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Vice President George Bush is just hours away from becoming his party's presidential nominee. Delegates to the Republican National Convention in New Orleans will stand up and be counted tonight as state by state the roll call vote is taken. Earlier, Bush presented his designated running mate to a news conference, saying Indiana Senator Dan Quayle is strongly qualified to be a heartbeat away from the presidency. Builders hoping to get a jump on rising interest rates sent the nation's housing starts up last month. New housing construction rose by 2.4% in July. The latest report does not reflect last week's increase in the prime rate. And economists, including David Siders of the National Home Builders Association, expect the pace of home building to slow down as mortgage rates climb.
So far, the numbers have been a little erratic throughout the year. Not much change in the underlying trend. Our concern certainly is the second half of the year and what the rate increases are going to mean.
Analysts say they don't foresee a repeat of the slowdown experienced in the early 1980s when the rate of housing starts fell to less than 1 million per year. A federal appeals court has delayed a decision on whether the city of Yonkers, New York, must pay federal fines levied because of the city's refusal to abide by a housing desegregation order. The Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Manhattan heard 2 hours of arguments from city and federal officials before asking both sides to return tomorrow with additional documents. In the meantime, court imposed fines against Yonkers and some city officials will remain frozen. Yonkers was ordered to pay the fines after its city council refused to comply with a court desegregation order to build subsidized housing in mostly white middle-class areas. Yonkers officials appealed, contending the fines will bankrupt the city. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 4 points today, closing at 2025.96. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review of a new recording of some of Chopin's greatest piano music, performed by the Cuban-born George Bolet. Bolet, who is now in his 70s, has recently been rediscovered.
George Bolet has been on the concert circuit for years, yet he's never become a great celebrity. I seem to recall his reputation as a young Turk. Lately, though, perhaps with a new revival of interest in the romantic repertoire he excels in, Bolet has suddenly emerged as an old master, concertizing and recording more actively than ever. He's probably best known for his vibrant performances of Liszt, much of which he's recorded in the past few years for London Records. There's an especially interesting Liszt CD on the Priceless label, originally recorded in 1960. His latest release is a Chopin album, including the four ballades, the Barcarolle, and the F minor fantasy. Bolet is digitally secure, elegant, intelligent in every way. He conveys the atmosphere and the structure of each of these intricate works. He does all the right things. He builds the magnificent F minor fantasy, for example, to a great climax, then pulls back at the end to reveal its quiet, almost childlike innocence, then a somber finality. And yet, when I compare some of these performances with my own favorite versions, I find something lacking here, some extra ounce of interpretive giving, some little personal fillip that makes a phrase get under my skin. Take the first ballade. Ballades are Chopin's own invention. The title sounds like a poem, a narrative poem, and Chopin's ballades have an episodic quality. Not looseness of structure so much as a sense of one event leading to another. Chopin may have derived this form from the epic poems of his Polish contemporary, Adam Mickiewicz. Listen to Bolet's pianism at the beginning of the first ballade. It's lovely, but there's no impulse to make the note sound anything beyond lovely. Then listen to the way Czech pianist Ivan Moravec begins to tell us the story of the first ballade. But there's at least one great performance on the new Bolet album, the Barcarolle. What makes Bolet's version so remarkable is his daring slow tempo. There are plenty of interpretive readings of this wonderful piece: Venice, the Grand Canal, Passion in a Gondola. But Bolette is not just depicting a slow gondola ride. He seems to be making a conscious musical decision to get away from the usual programmatic, storytelling content. Different, it seems to me, from his complacency and reticence in the ballades, where the storytelling is built into the music. Here, what he tells us, is that the barcarolle can be heard as pure music, that it works magnificently if you just listen to it slowly unfold its musical secrets, that neither the concert hall nor the recording studio have to turn into Venice for this piece to be understood and appreciated. If Bolette has neither the impetuosity and Italianate lilt of an Alfred Cortot, nor Dino Lipotti's rapture or sublime grace, the insights he brings are profoundly revealing and completely convincing on their own terms.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new London recording of George Bolette playing Chopin's ballades, barcarolle, and fantasy. This is Fresh Air. Ever since Jack Towers retired from his job as a broadcaster for the Department of Agriculture in 1974, he's turned his love of jazz music into a new career. Towers is a remastering engineer, and he spends his days and sometimes nights restoring vintage jazz recordings. The process can be long and tedious. First, Towers transfers the music from either a scratchy 78 or a hissy acetate disc to tape, and then he begins to eliminate the pops, crackles, and surface noises. His expertise is always in demand. He's worked on many Smithsonian recordings, and he won a Grammy for a record set he recorded and later restored of the Duke Ellington Band playing in Fargo, North Dakota in 1940. Towers is currently restoring the collection of discs of Charlie Parker recorded by Dean Benedetti. Benedetti was a professional saxophonist and fanatical Parker fan. In 1947 and 48, Benedetti followed Parker around from club to club, recording his solos, capturing Parker, the working musician, playing night after night. Let's listen to one of the Charlie Parker recordings Jack Towers will be working on. This is Ornithology. Piece of music has a story behind it, but this recording has an especially extraordinary story. Had you heard a lot of stories about these recordings before you actually heard them yourself?
Well, years ago, I remember the story of somebody going into the night spots where Parker was playing and with a disc recorder starting to record just before Parker's solo came, and then when Parker would finish, why, he would lift up the cutting head. But it was just a story, and you couldn't help but wonder whether we would ever hear the material.
Right, and this person's name was Dean Benedetti.
That's right.
And Dean Benedetti used to follow Parker around the clubs, right?
That's right.
And record him playing there. What was your first reaction when you found out that these tapes, that these records actually existed and that you were going to work on it?
It was a shock, and of course, I then remembered the story. And you can imagine a pleasure for me to be called upon to take these recordings and get them onto tape.
So what do you have to do now? What kind of work do you have to do?
Well, of course, these are quite clean, but when they are kind of noisy with clicks and pops, then I take the tape and locate exactly where the clicks and ticks and pops are and mark it precisely on the tape, and then I turn the tape over and very carefully etch off these clicks and pops just to clean it up.
Etch it off. What do you use?
Well, I use like a little X-Acto knife with a very sharp tip that I can make it scratch the oxide of the tape and just, in effect, spoil the response of the tape at that very precise point. And the tick disappears, and when you listen to the tape, you don't realize that anything has happened.
How many scratches and pops do you think you have to etch out per minute of music in your typical vintage recording?
Oh, I would say maybe 36.
That's a lot.
Some are clean, but some are very, very noisy. And there's kind of a limit to how much you can do without it sounding as though something has happened to it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to kind of be very careful what you're doing there.
Do you relate to Benedetti traveling around with a portable recorder? Didn't you do a little bit of that yourself?
Yes, I didn't do a whole lot of traveling, but I did record Duke Ellington in 1940 with some portable disc equipment.
I think we can use some of that to show what a record sounds like before you've worked on it and what it sounds like after.
Yeah.
These records that you made at a 1940 concert, years later, you cleaned up with your technique for a reissue. Why don't we listen to how it sounded on that 1940 recording that you originally made? Okay, why don't we give that a listen?
Okay.
And this is a recording of The Mooch, Duke Ellington and his orchestra, recorded in 1940 at the Crystal Ballroom in Fargo, North Dakota. Now, when you were listening back to this, knowing you were going to clean it up for a reissue, what were you listening for?
Well, you mean when I cleaned it up just in recent years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, each of those little ticks and things that you can hear other than the instruments.
Well, let's hear what it sounded like after you got those noises
out. Okay.
Now, what are some of the sounds that you can't ever get out when you're reworking on a record?
Well, certain long smears that extend over the music, noises of considerable length. But even these usually are broken up into individual clicks or pops. So it's hard to say what you can't do if you want to really work at it.
It seems to me that what you're doing is very state-of-the-art. I mean, you're really considered one of the absolute best in terms of restoring early jazz recordings. On the other hand, you're doing it manually in a lot of ways. You're literally
I am doing it manually, but we're anticipating that the digital people will really come in and take care of all of this. And I'm hoping that we can depend on the industry to really do a really good job at what a few of us are doing by hand.
If a digital technique for cleaning up these records becomes perfected, will that make your technique obsolete?
Oh, I should think it would.
Uh-huh.
And I can't wait.
Oh, really?
Because there's a lot of things I'd rather do than sit all day just etching on a piece of tape.
Well, if that's how you feel, what keeps you at it?
Well, the end product of getting some of this music that I really think a lot of and getting it to people in good shape and so that it can be, put on the shelf and kept forever.
Is this, in a way, is taking out these pops and scratches, in a way, like playing your instrument?
Well, you might, I guess you could. I know nothing about music, and I can't play anything, but I do play a good phonograph. So maybe it is.
Now, sound keeps getting better and better, especially with compact discs now. The sound sounds so clean. Are you expected to clean things up even more than you used to in order for remastering on CD?
Yeah, if it's aimed for a CD, I think I just work a little more carefully and a little more thoroughly on it. I've done maybe 20, 30 CDs. And something over 500 LPs, so I've got a little experience behind me on that.
Now, I know some remastering engineers like to remix the music and change the sounds of the bass and the drums to make it sound more contemporary. Do you believe in doing that kind of thing?
Well, depends on the source material. I have a very good listening setting where I work, and I do trust my ears on how I balance out the frequencies. I may have to lift the low end a little bit, or maybe the mid-range, or notch out resonances or hums, things like that. So I do trust my ears, although they're getting kind of old.
What kind of challenge do you most welcome in your work?
Oh, music that really means something to me. Duke Ellington or this Charlie Parker material, things like that really have musical significance. I really love to take a shot at.
The complete Dean Benedetti Charlie Parker recordings, remastered by Jack Towers, will be available early next year from Mosaic Records of Stamford, Connecticut. Here's a preview from the set of recordings Towers is preparing to work on. This is Fresh Air. Let's see how All Things Considered is shaping up and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry. How are you?
How are you covering the death of President Zia of Pakistan?
Well, we're following events there as best we can through the BBC's George Arney, who is in Islamabad, the Pakistani capital. Also here, we're asking people in Washington about the importance of the death of the Pakistani president and about what might happen next there. We also have a special report this evening from Howard Burkus on Morton Thiokol, the company which makes the solid-fuel booster rockets for the shuttle. They were asked to go and make them again after the terrible shuttle disaster, and we'll find out what they did. Tomorrow, of course, is a test firing of the new shuttle.
Thanks, Robert. That and more is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Republicans gathered at their party convention in New Orleans this week are spending a good deal of their time either making speeches or listening to them.
I've been doing a little remembering of my own because of all that inflated rhetoric by our friends in Atlanta last month. But then inflation is their specialty.
Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on political oratory.
However the parties try to jazz up their conventions, there's no getting around the fact that they're still basically occasions for windy oratory, to the obvious distress of the networks who have to cover them. Whoever is up there thumping the lectern in Atlanta or New Orleans, the TV is almost sure to be carrying an interview with a 91-year-old delegate from Kansas, or a chat between Dan Rather and Walter Cronkite about the sorry state of this year's political oratory, while the camera pans the hall like a restless schoolboy. But there was a time when this sort of speechifying was regarded as the mainstay of democracy. In the words of one 19th century school book, oratory is the parent of liberty. In fact, the famous McGuffey's Reader was really a textbook on public speaking, which began with instructions on articulation and gesture, and which included sample orations by the likes of Patrick Henry and Daniel Webster, which pupils were required to learn by heart. 19th century oratory was not just a political duty, but an enormously popular public entertainment. When Anthony Trollope visited the United States from England in 1861, he was astonished to find that public lectures outdrew theaters and concerts as popular attractions, so much so that 2,000 or 3,000 people might turn out to hear a star like Edward Everett or Ralph Waldo Emerson declaiming on the events of the day. And the people who attended one of the Lincoln-Douglas debates of 1854 could expect to sit through as much as 7 hours of argument and rebuttal without commercial interruptions. The high watermark of 19th century political oratory was surely the 1896 Democratic Convention in Chicago, when a boy wonder ex-congressman from Nebraska named William Jennings Bryan carried off the nomination with a stirring oration attacking the gold standard, with its famous peroration, "You shall not press down upon the brow of labor this crown of thorns. You shall not crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." Yet before Bryan died in 1925, he was regarded as a political fossil, though that's a word he probably would have objected to, the prototype for the pompous Senator gas bag that became a fixture of political cartoons. The old-fashioned oratory was partly a victim of the more informal style of the 20th century and partly of new technologies. Already in 1924, the Democratic Convention had been carried over the radio. Less than a decade later, FDR would hold the first of his fireside chats, which gave the illusion of a homey, intimate exchange between the president sitting in his parlor and the audience sitting in theirs. It remained only for television to make oratory appear grotesque. Indeed, TV seems to be unable to sit still for any form of language that can't be carried in a 15-second bite. And yet there are moments when the networks feel themselves obliged to carry a speech in its entirety, and when we suddenly get a glimpse of the magic that a great orator can work on a hall. There was Mario Cuomo's keynote address to the Democrats in 1984, and Jesse Jackson's speech this year. Unfortunately, the Republicans have been short on spellbinders since Everett Dirksen died. It's a reminder of how much fun 19th century American politics must have been, and you want to ask, in the words of the poet Vachel Lindsay, "Where is that boy, that heaven-born Bryan, that Homer Bryan who sang from the West, gone to join the shadows with Altgeld the Eagle, where the kings and the slaves and the troubadours rest?"
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Here's a look at tomorrow's fresh air. Tomorrow, the revenge humor of Margaret Smith, who says she's not on stage to get love, she's on stage to get even. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the work and the paradox of Frank Zappa. Through his own record label, Zappa is transferring many of his studio recordings and live performances onto compact discs. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Married to the Mob, starring Michelle Pfeiffer, Dean Stockwell, and Matthew Modine, and directed by Jonathan Demme. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Deborah Beagle. Research assistance from Martin Foyes. Our engineer is Orjiv Oblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.